Greetings. Welcome to Cuke Audio. I'm DC Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio. We're going to have a little chat here for quite some time with Tygan Dan Layton, who's the teacher of the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate in Chicago, and the author of a number of books. So here we go. So hello, Tygan.
Hello, David.
So, it's a pleasure speaking with you. When did you come to Zen Center?
I came to San Francisco Zen Center in mid-1978. I had already been doing daily Zazen, Soto Zen from January 75. I started with a Japanese Soto Zen priest in the Upper West Side of New York City in what was then called the New York Zen Center.
Would you say his name again?
His name is Hando Nakajima. We called him Nakajima Sensei.
Uh-huh.
He was a Soto Zen priest, trained, I believe, at Sojiji. And he was really good. His English wasn't very good. His English never got as good as Katagiri Roshi's, for example. He worked downtown in Midtown at a Japanese company. So he didn't have as much English speaking practice as maybe some of the Japanese priests who came did. He was there every evening, Monday through Friday. And then he did a Sunday morning talk. And he did a monthly all-day sitting.
Huh.
And he did Dokusan one evening a week and Zazen instruction. And there was usually two periods of Zazen unless there was also a talk.
Mm-hmm.
And which he did one evening a week and Sunday morning. And really, despite all of my years at San Francisco Zen Center, after mid-78, what I'm doing now in Chicago in our little storefront temple is more like what Reverend Nakajima did in New York.
Uh-huh.
In my experience, we have a non-residential temple where we do, now everything is different because we're doing things on Zoom during the pandemic, but ordinarily we've been doing, in the pre-pandemic normal, we did a Sunday morning Dharma talk and Zazen and Dharma talk, a Monday evening Zazen and Dharma talk. Tuesday evening we had a Buddhist-style meditation recovery. We had a Wednesday morning sitting before the pandemic, and then Thursday evening a sitting and then an informal discussion about Suki Roshi. So anything from something from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, different practice leaders started, initiated, and it's reading from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind are not always so. And then we also have a group that we're in the north side of Chicago, for people who know Chicago, North Central. We also have a part of our Sangha is down in Hyde Park at the University of Chicago, and there's a Wednesday afternoon sitting and talk at Rockefeller Chapel, the big cathedral in the center of University of Chicago campus in Hyde Park. So that's our usual, what we usually do, but it's non-residential. So it's not like, nothing like City Center of Green Gulch, Utah Sahara, all of which I practiced at. So anyway, that's, that goes back though to, in some ways, my earlier experience in New York. But then I came in mid-78 to San Francisco Zen Center. My wife and I, at the time, relocated to San Francisco, and I started going to City Center. Reb was the Tonto, and I kind of connected with him immediately. But also, Baker Roshi was my teacher. Everybody was a practice student of his back then. So anyway, I came and I attended classes and sat regularly and living not far away. And anyway, that's... So that's when I came to Zen Center.
I loved your reminding me about your your center and you know where you sit in Chicago, because I remember fondly being there 9 days with you, and Hyde Park, Rockefeller's, what's it called? Rockefeller Center?
Rockefeller Chapel.
Chapel.
It's a huge,
beautiful.
Yeah, it's a huge Gothic cathedral. It's very funny to sit there because, you know, we're right in the center up in the nave of the cathedral, and it's this huge ceilings, and there's sometimes the bells are going, and it's kind of a strange place to sit. You know, people know about sitting outside, which is wonderful. Our temple on the north side is a relatively small room. It fits a couple dozen or so. We can get a few dozen in there as we stretch, but it's a couple dozens off Zafus. But sitting in a huge cathedral is strange because, you know, yeah. The space is open, and you know, it's just different from anything else. I've been to many Zafus, but it's one of the strangest ones.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed it. I loved your Zendo. I loved the people. They were really good to me. And one neat thing was a couple of them worked at the Field Museum. Is that what
it's
called?
You had the tour, yes.
More than the tour. I had more than the tour. I spent time there. It was, you know, I got to hang out. It was great. And hang out in the back rooms and... It was just wonderful.
Yeah, one of our priests, Yoshinora Ross, she worked there many, many years as the head of conservation and still is associated, even though she's formally retired. But that's an amazing, one of the many amazing institutions in Chicago. I love Chicago. But it's a natural history museum, a global research center, and it's also an activist organization because they send people down to South America and Africa and South Asia to help indigenous people kind of... And also to research, you know, animal and plant species. And so it's an amazing institution, one of many in Chicago.
So you're the founding teacher of the...
Dragon Zen Gate.
Yeah.
And it's in Chicago, and you can look it up, ancientdragon.org. And so
right.
There's a lot of time in between 1978 and 2007, I was living at or involved with or, you know, in some way connected with San Francisco Zen Center. I had... I lived at Tassajara in the early 80s at Green Gulch at City Center. But beginning of 2007, my Dharma brother Tayo drove me across from California to Chicago. And so I relocated to Chicago and I had some students here. And they persuaded me to move to Chicago. And now I have this cute little storefront temple. So.
Yeah, I know. I think it's neat. Something else I want to bring up about you, which I've always been extremely impressed with your scholarship and with your books. How many books have you written or co-authored with Shohaku Okamura?
Oh, with Shohaku, just three. I translations of Dogen, including Dogen's extensive record, which is, oh gosh, it's, I don't know, 600 pages or something. I could go get it across the room. But it's the one of Dogen's, people don't know it as well as Shogenza. Shogenza is one of Dogen's masterworks, but this is his utter masterwork, almost as long as Shogenza, or the longest version of Shogenza, called Indabini's Eihei Koroku. It's the extensive record, Dogen's extensive record. So it includes Dogen's talks from the time he started getting very short, formal, I call them Dharma Hall discourses. Jodo in Japanese. But anyway, there's these short formal talks where everybody is standing, and he was speaking in the Dharma Hall. Yeah, it's 800 pages long, this book, anyway.
Yeah, it's something.
People told me it's kind of to be used as a weapon, but anyway, it's from I think 1243 when he started giving talks. So his last year of 1652, and they are different from Shobo Genzo because they're short, most of them. A lot of them are about koans, but they're very short and direct. Even though they're more formal in a way than Shobo Genzo, they are also more personal in a way. Some of them show his sense of humor and just his personality. But then that book, that massive extensive record, also includes a chapter of his informal, longer meetings with students, and then another chapter with 90, another volume with 90 koans with his first commentary. So I work with that a lot. And then there's a selection of his poetry, including early poetry from when he was a student in China. So anyway, that's one of the few things I did with Shohaku. Those are translations with my editing and production. And then there's also a number of other books that I've written about Dogen and about Soto Zen. I think I've done maybe two books altogether. I lose count. But my first book was also a translation called Cultivating the Empty Field. And that's actually the book that most people mention to me when they mention my books, because it's sort of a minor cult classic, but it's translation of practice talks by Hongzhe Zhangzhui, is his name in Chinese. He was the most important Soto teacher the century before Dogen in China. The Shaodong is called in Chinese. Shaodong is Soto in Japanese. But he was in the lineage from that goes back to Dongshan. So my first book was translations from Hongzhe, and then very beautiful prose, kind of, but very poetic descriptions of kind of the experience of Zazen. He calls it serene illumination or silent illumination, and so it's these beautiful descriptions of the meditative experience, really. So that's this little book called Cultivating the Empty Field, which has those talks and then some of his poetry and just a selection. I was inspired to write that because there's a tiny bit of stuff from him in that book that Tom Cleary did early on called Timeless Spring, which was the first real book about Soto besides Dogen. And anyway, so I did that as my master's thesis, Cultivating the Empty Field, and then it became a book. What I meant about Timeless Spring is that Tom Cleary's book, early book, was gave more of the history, not just Dogen, but the history going back into China. That's where I found out about Hongzhe, and I did a master's thesis. I came back from Tassajara and was ordained in 85 or 86, anyway. I came back from Tassajara after a few years at Tassajara. I went to this, was I working at San Francisco Zen Center? I guess I was. I was working at the bakery probably again. I worked at the bakery, Tassajara Bakery, for a long time. We're not going in chronological order anymore, obviously. But you asked about my books, so I'm talking about the first book was I came back from Tassajara, and I found out that Tom Cleary was teaching at this school, California Institute of Integral Studies, which was then in the Haight-Ashbury. It's now over near Van Ness. Anyway, I enrolled in that just because I wanted to study with Tom Cleary, because I'd been reading, his book of Serenity and the Flower Ornament Sutra and all those book with records he'd done. And he was, so I spent a year studying with him at California Institute of Integral Studies, which is still there, and at San Francisco Zen Studies giving classes. And then he kind of withdrew from, you know, all public activities. But I spent some time with him, and we went for walks after class and stuff. So I got to know him a little, and he is a brilliant man. Anyway, his book, Time of Spring, was what inspired me to write, to try and translate some of Hongzhou's writings. And I did that as a master's thesis with a very fine Chinese professor there named Yi Wu helping me. And I have a story about that book, though, that when I finished the translation, I took it to my advisor, who was a Tibetan Buddhist scholar named Mark Tatz, who's published a few things, T-A-T-Z. And I gave it to him, and then I went back to see him, and I thought I'd finished and done it. And he just handed it back to me and said, "This is no good, start over." And he was right. It was one of the best, best, kindest things anybody's done for me, because he said, you know, you translated the words, but not the meaning. So I went back and went through it paragraph by paragraph. There's little sections, there's 57 little Dharma talks. They're very poetic and lots of nature imagery. But I had to go back and sit zazen with each one of them and figure out, find out through zazen, what is the teaching here? What's the meaning here? So that's what led to that translation, which a lot of people really like. Anyway, that was my first book. That was sort of the background to Dogen's. Part of this, so going back five steps, this is way out of chronological order. Now I'm jumping around.
Yeah, wait a minute. Remind us the name, you know, of that book again.
Cultivating the Empty Field, the Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hongzhi, Hongzhi. It's now available from Tuttle. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people tell me they have it by a bedside or something. It's something you can go back to, just like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, of course. That's sort of Dogen's a literary predecessor a century before in China. Hongzhi wrote a lot, maybe not quite as much as Dogen, but part of this, all of my books, in some ways, all of my studies, come from when I first had zazen instruction with Nakajima Sensei in the Upper West Side in New York.
What year?
January 1975.
Mm-hmm.
4 years after I came back from spending a few months wandering around temples in Kyoto and Nara, being blown away by Japanese Buddhist statues and Zen gardens and temples and. But I didn't know that I could have anything to do with that. I ended up coming back, going back to school, and then I ended up in New York City and working as a film editor. I worked in documentary films and TV news a lot in New York, and then for a little while in San Francisco when I moved. But I had this zazen instruction from Nakajima Sensei. He talked about Dogen. And he talked about Dogen all the time. And he read from the one bad translation that was available, then he would talk about it. Dogen grabbed me. Zazen and Dogen together kind of got me. And I decided to go back to school to find out who this Dogen guy was. So I went back to Columbia College in New York, finished my undergraduate degree, but studied Japanese language and studied Chinese and Japanese history and religion and literature. I class with Donald Sheen, who was a great master of Japanese literature, period. So skipping a number of years, so I came to San Francisco Zen Center, and there's lots to say about that. From 78 on. when I started, you were asking about my books, when I started with Hongzhe, it was partly to understand, and all of my studying is to understand who this Dogen guy was. I wanted to find out the background. So my first book was Cultivating the Anti-Field by Hongzhe. My most recent book, I think it was published 2015, maybe, is called Just This Is It, Dongshan and the Practice of Suchness.
Oh, yeah.
And that's from Shambhala, and that's about the founder of what we call Soto Zen from Japanese. It's Cao Dong in Chinese. Dongshan, Tozan in Japanese. And Suki Roshi talked about him a lot. But he was the guy who wrote the Kyozama, the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. He is said to have originated the five degrees or five ranks. And there's lots of koans about him. So my book, my most recent book is Justice Is It, Dongshan and the Practice of Suchness. And that's about, and he was back in the 800s, so way back. So he's like the beginning of Soto Zen. But a lot of what he has to say, so most of the book is about the koans and stories about him and about his teacher some. And then there's a section on the Jewel Mirror Samadhi and a section on the five degrees or five ranks or something it's called, which mm-hmm. is kind of the philosophical background of Soto Zen. Anyway, there's all through that book, there's lots of references to Dogen and also references to Suzuki Roshi and things that Suzuki mm-hmm. Roshi said about that material. And, so that was my most recent book. But all of those books and all the books in between are, were for me trying to understand the background of Dogen, which is also the background of Suzuki Roshi. I can tell you about the other books in between. There were the translations with Shohaku. Then there's a book I did called Visions of Awakening, Space and Time.
Oh, yeah.
Dogen and the Lotus Sutra. That's my most academic book in a way that was based on my PhD dissertation that I got later at Graduate Theological Union, where I've been teaching since I got the job from Norman Fisher in 94. He had been teaching there and handed it off to me. But anyway, that book on Dogen and the Lotus Sutra, people think, I think in America, in American Zen, a lot of people think of Zen as sort of something that, separate from Buddhism or is just, well, there's that slogan without words and letters, there's a kind of therapeutic aspect of, how a lot of people come to Zen and to meditation. And that's understandable. People come from some problem or some suffering or some question, and but actually, I got from having been in Japan first for a few months in 1970, and then for more than 2 years, 90 to 92, living in Kyoto. It was just this background of the culture. It's in Japanese culture. It's not about Japanese culture, but it's sort of embedded in Japanese culture, and all this history in East Asia. And there's this kind of ground of that. So Dogen very much revered the Lotus Sutra, as Suzuki Roshi did. Suzuki Roshi lectured on the Lotus Sutra. It's very important. The most important Buddhist scripture in East Asia anyway. And so Dogen refers to it much more than any other sutra. So I talk, that book is about Dogen's teachings from the Lotus Sutra, but a lot of what Dogen does with it is very creative, but also I think it speaks to a lot of current issues about understanding the world. There's things about it that echo modern physics, and how Dogen uses things in the Lotus Sutra to talk about space and time. And One of the books I did with Shohaku Okamura called The Wholehearted Way is a translation of Endo Wah, one of Dogen's earliest writings about meditation. And it's got this sentence in it. There's a section called the Self-Fulfillment Samadhi or Self-Realization Samadhi that's sometimes chanted. It's part of Endo Wah, but it's got the sentence in there by Dogen, which is one of my favorite Dogen sentences. He says, when one person sits upright and displays Buddha Mudra with their whole body and mind, even for a little while, then all of space is enlightened. All of reality is enlightened. That sentence that I translated with Shohaku, just, you know, is in some ways all of Dogen is a commentary on that sentence. Just the idea that it's not when we sit zazen, we're not just, you know, kind of finding our own personal peace and calm and all that, which, you know, that's part of it. But there's actually some relationships with the whole environment. He goes on in that, right after that sentence, to talk about the mutual guidance between the person sitting zazen and earth, grasses, trees, pebbles, tiles, walls and fences, even, you know, so-called man-made things, that there's this field of awareness that zazen activates. This is not how we usually think about meditation or practice in the West. You know, we think of it through a psychological lens, which is great, but this is a really deep environmental teaching about our interconnectedness. And, you know, we're speaking now in the pandemic age when we're all totally interconnected through this virus, through biology. And, you know, I've thought of this as kind of like when people first went up into space, when they first went to the moon and they took pictures of, you remember when the first pictures came of Earth from a distance and we could see the whole ball of the planet, and it just changed how we saw where we live.
And we couldn't see the whole planet. That's why Stuart Brand went on a whole, they weren't sending pictures of the whole Earth. Stuart Brand stood maybe in front of Sproul Hall or something at UC Berkeley with a big poster that say, "We want to see a picture of the whole Earth." And went on a big campaign to get one. Pardon me. Go on. But after a while, he was successful, and then we did get pictures of the whole Earth. But even the small pictures of the Earth were impressive with the curvature of the world.
Yeah, no, no, yes, good. Thank you for that part of it. Yeah, that, at some point we start. I'm just saying that what Dogen says about how, you know, we're connected with our environment. He didn't use that word. He just said Earth is Earth, grasses and trees, fences and walls, tiles and pebbles. Everything awakens when we awaken, when we sit zazen. So this is a way of talking about interconnectedness, which is an important old teaching in East Asian Buddhism. It goes back to India, of course, but part of my Dongshan book is talking about that and Huayan Buddhism, which I love, which is comes from the Flower Ornament Sutra. And so the whole idea of interconnectedness in Buddhism that we can, you know, we get a sense of somehow if we do zazen for a while. And Dogen says even the first time, and actually I resonate with that because the first time I did zazen in New York City, it's just, wow, this is it. I was trying to connect that with what's happening now. We're speaking in the pandemic age when the COVID virus is around and has effects on all of us, and we know that is affecting the whole world biologically. So
yeah,
the whole human world, I should say, maybe beyond human.
Oh no, it's affecting everything because of the Oh yeah, there's all sorts of massive environmental effects from it. The reduced activity on Earth. There's less vibration coming from the world, and you know all sorts of things.
Yeah, so part of what I'm thinking about these days is just how do we get what is the new normal going to be like? We can't go back to normal the way it was before. Everything's changed, and we don't understand yet what that is, and we have to try and make it.
Right. Well, we can't see the future. We can't see the future. There might be other things. There's going to be other unexpected things happening.
Oh, sure. And that's part of what Dogen's talking about in terms of being time and the reality of time. And I talk about it in that book about Dogen and the Lotus Sutra. Before that, though, I wrote a book. You know, I was talking about the effect being in Japan had on me in terms of seeing this background of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my first books that wasn't a translation, it was about bodhisattva archetypes, faces of compassion.
I remember that.
Faces of compassion, classic bodhisattva archetypes and their modern expression. And that was specifically, I wrote that because I'd been aware, because of the beautiful statues in Kyoto and Nara of Buddhas and bodhisattvas. I was aware of these bodhisattva figures. They're in our meal chants, you know, at Zen Center, and they're part of the culture. But I wrote this book to kind of go through, you know, the seven major ones in East Asia that are also in Zen, and who they are and what schools and sutras they represent and what their practices are. So I did that book to open up that kind of awareness, because it's the kind of ground or background or underground or whatever of our practice. And so that book, I think, was helpful to expose that to people and help people see, understand.
Wasn't that the book where you brought up some modern day people too?
Yeah, so the thing is that each of these bodhisattvas, so people know them, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, Kanon or Guanyin or Shenrezig, everybody knows if you go into it, anybody who's been in a Chinese restaurant and seen the goddess of mercy, they sometimes call her, but that's Kanon, Guanyin, who's very important as the bodhisattva of compassion, and Maitreya, who everybody also knows if you've gone into a Chinese restaurant, because one of his manifestations was Hotai, fat, jolly Chinese laughing Buddha, is said to be a manifestation of him. Anyway, there's these seven bodhisattva figures, each of whom has a particular kind of strategy to practice, and it's really an introduction to the whole Mahayana by seeing the schools and sutras and that. But I also did this thing that, you know, I think it's what first got it published, is I added at the end of each chapter these little kind of playful descriptions of various modern, you know, culture figures and people who we know from the West mostly, who are examples of these bodhisattva energies, to
right.
put it that way.
Right.
So I've got...
Give an example.
Yeah, yeah. So for the bodhisattva of compassion, I have Mother Teresa, but also Albert Schweitzer. And for the bodhisattva of wisdom, Manjushri, who sits in the middle of Zendos with sword off or sitting on a lion sometimes, is he, you know, for examples of him, I have like... Bob Dylan, of course, and Gertrude Stein, and I forget who all I put in there. Einstein, of course.
Yes.
Perfectly. Yes. But I go into the texture of how the folklore about each of these figures. So I have Martin Luther King in there. I have Jackie Robinson in there. I have. Clint Eastwood and Thomas Jefferson.
Clint Eastwood, that is very far out. Very far out.
Yeah, he, as an example of the Mahakirti, the great enlightened layman. Anyway, so the reasons why each of these people fit at least some aspect of those bodhisattva energies. So that's why, you know, so I have, I don't know, half a dozen or so people at the end of each chapter that, you know, are kind of exemplify aspects of that bodhisattva energy.
That's interesting. You'd mention, I mentioned a book I've been working on for 5 years. Not that I'm working on it all the time because I can't get to it because I do so many other things.
I understand.
Yeah, you understand. Is Tassara Stories. And I have little bit about Clint Eastwood in it because he was the landlord of the Cummings Brothers where we did work there. And I talked to him about that once. Super nice guy.
I like his films. I'm a fan of his, you know.
I love his films, yeah.
Yeah.
Not real one of his politics, but he was, he was very popular as the mayor, and he really cares about people and very sociable, personable guy. It comes across rather humble, really. And in his Playboy interview, he said, "Oh, the old gun thing." He said, "Well, you know, I'm an actor. Those are props." He said, "I'm in favor of all gun laws." I couldn't believe reading that. Anyway, I have some questions.
Well, go
on.
He's also a great musician. I mean, he does jazz, and he did that movie about Bird, about Charlie Parker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He does. Yeah. He and his son both do music for his movies. And actually, where I talked to him was at a K-Jazz fundraiser in San Francisco that Liz and I went to. And that was an incredible event. Tony Bennett singing and, wonderful.
So the other book that I wrote starts as a sort of collection of my talks, but it's called Zen Questions, Zazen, Dogen, and the Spirit of Creative Inquiry. And there's five sections in it, a couple on Dogen, a couple on favorite poets. The last one is on kind of modern social, societal implications of it. But the first section is about Zazen and about how Zen, so in the title, Zazen is about questioning. Zen questions is a verb. So anyway, that's another book of mine that I like. So
yeah, amazing. You just spit them out like incredible. Like Cleary. Not as much as Cleary. Yeah, amazing, huh? And he had more. He had stacks of books he'd translated. He just needed money for them or something to get by. He was always struggling. What's happening with him now?
Oh, I don't know. Nobody knows. I think he's still putting out stuff, but he's not available to interact with people. He just,
I can understand that. He's socially a very uncomfortable person in many ways, is what I found.
Yeah. Yeah, but I actually spent a year really getting to know him, and I understand his... he's sensitive in a lot of ways, but a brilliant, wonderful man who made a huge contribution. So,
and I think it's great. See, that's true with anybody. If you get close to him... And, almost anybody will have somebody that's close to them that really appreciates them. Kansei was difficult, too, but look, Rick Levine and was very close with him.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know about Kansei, and I know about, I mean, so that was a little before I got to Zen Center, but I know Linda Ruth and Reb and numbers of people from Zen Center went and studied with him in Berkeley. So
Rick was the one who was closest with him. Okay, more on books.
Maybe that's enough.
All right.
People can go to my website, my Sangha website, ancientdragon.org, and go to the section where it has all the stuff on my books, and probably left out a couple anyway.
I have a section on Cuke.com, Tigan's books, but I think I just linked to your section. Now, I'll check that to make sure.
Yeah, I looked at it. It works. It's good.
Yeah, I have to link to yours. You know, I couldn't keep up. And I also have the Tigan's Peace and Justice page, because that's an enormous part of your story. But I'm going to ask you, oh, I want to mention
something. We could go into that if you want to, but go ahead.
Later. Because I wanted to mention you, I just remembered that I talked about you in comments on chapter one of Crooked Cucumber, which I told about, because I was commenting on how the boys ran ahead with their tabi on while Soane was behind without tabi, and they ran ahead because there were mamushi, the poisonous snake, there. And, you know, and then he scolded them for wearing tabi when he wasn't. But then I talk about mamushi.
Who was that?
Soane. Gyeongjun Soane, Suzuki's teacher, his master. When he was very young.
Yes.
Anyway, so then I talk about mamushi, the poisonous snakes. And then I talk about mukade, the Japanese centipedes. And
yes.
Then I talked about how you got bitten by one in our home and all that.
Oh, I forgot about that. You reminded me.
Yeah, you can read all about it, or you can listen all about it. And you know, when you mentioned the work you did based on Dogen's Bindowa, I had a car. I had a couple of cars where I got vanity plates, and one of them I used Bendo. And I worked that out with Moriyama, who is the priest over at Sokoji, you know.
Okay.
What should I use for this one? And I can't remember what the one I had beforehand was. Because it's negotiating the way, right? So
yeah.
It's like driving, Bendo. And somebody borrowed that car from me in Bolinas, and at 13 corners, somebody came around the corner and ran head on into him, ran side on into him. And you know that guy, he was a poor school teacher in Bolinas, and he paid for the repair and rented me a car while it was happening. And, you know, God, glad it wasn't your average lawyer or doctor, they would have gotten out of it. But the people at the shop that fixed it took a picture of it with the license plate because it was bent. You know, Bendo.
Uh-huh.
They just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. I just wanted to mention that. All right, now here's something a little more Buddhist.
Buddhist, David.
It's all Buddhist. That's Buddha too. That's Bendo Buddha. one thing, and I asked Shohaku about this in a talk at Green Gulch he was giving, because you know how people sometimes bring up something they want to get the teacher to say something that agrees with them? Well, he did. I brought up the way they chant the four vows, the translation of it, which, and I'm responsible for this because I created the character study that was used, I think, Richard Baker, because I was just giving the meaning of the words, and I said, and on the last line, this young man, right? The last line, Buddhist way is unsurpassable, I vow to, and the normal thing up to that point was attain it. But I said that it means, the word means to become. So then at Zen Center, I vow to become it. And I was never comfortable with that, just English-wise. Just thought it was weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, what do you think? How do you think that line should be translated?
At our temple, we say, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it.
There you go. See, that works in English. That flows. It doesn't, you don't stop and go, I vow to become it, you know?
It's partly that to realize, I like that word, and we talk about practice realization rather than practice enlightenment, but realization as a word for, you know, what sometimes is to become, to real, to enlighten, you know, that to realize means to make real, to make it real,
mm-hmm.
you know.
There you go. That's good.
As well as, you know, sort of it could be used to understand it, but, you know, understanding our usual Western understanding of what understanding means doesn't work in Buddhism, you know, because we have this linear, you know, idea of figuring out something, and that's part of it. But when you sit, you know, in Zazen and when you, you know, in practice, you make something real, you understand it. You know, I'll another story you mentioned, Shoyaku. I went to, after I was Shusoa Tassajara in spring 90, somewhere just before that, I saw Shohaku, and I talked to him about moving to Japan to work on translations with him of Dogen, because that's after I did Cultivating the Empty Field. There was I decided to do that because of one word. There's a story that you probably know about, it's in Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, where, you know, how do you think, what do you, the student asks the teacher, what are you doing sitting there so steadfastly? And he says, I'm thinking of not thinking. Mm-hmm. And the student says, how do you think of not thinking? And the translations that's still used by a lot of people is non-thinking. And that never made, you know, I never understood what in English, thinking, non-thinking, what's the difference? What does that mean? Shohaku Okamura translated that as, the second one, as beyond thinking.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Thank you. Because, good. Thank you.
Yeah. And actually caused it a book later, Tanahashi, who is an important part of my story, did a book called Beyond Thinking Later. But the idea that what happens, so talking about understanding, in Zazen, it's not that we get rid of all thinking. It's not that we try not to think, because thoughts, you know, thoughts come and go. That's part of reality. As Shohaku's teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, said that when we're sitting, our stomach continues to secrete digestive juices and our brain continues to secrete thoughts. But beyond thinking is kind of, it includes thinking and not thinking, and it's thinking of what's beyond them. And so anyway, I like that translation, and that's why I moved to Japan for 2 years to, and not the only reason, but that's why I wanted to go back to Japan. But that's why I worked with Shohaku for 2 years in Japan. And then later on at City Center and at Sokoji, worked on the Dogen's extensive record with him. But that one word made me want to work with Shohaku.
That's really great. That's really great. I met him during that time, maybe because of you. I don't know why. Elin and I went to that little home temple of his near Kyoto, outside of town somewhere. I don't remember where.
Near Sonobe was the town that's near. And it was just, the 2 years I was living in Kyoto, I would go out twice a week when he wasn't away and spend the day, and took a while to get there. I had to take a bus ride and a train ride and a bus ride, but spend the day with him translating the Pindarawa book and another book I did, translation of Dogen's Eihei Shinki, Dogen's Pure Standards for the Zen Community, was the English name. So he had this little temple in this little rice village, you know, tiny village, you know, outside of a small town. So, yeah.
Yeah. I really liked him from the very first. I've always just had the highest regard for him. You know, there's something about Japanese, you know, culture, the way people the priests that come out of that system, they focus. They're much less complicated than Americans, and they focus on, you know, what they learned and what their role is, and you can depend on them. I mean, I mean, Americans are just so all over the place. Well, the Japanese are too, but I'm just talking about the Japanese priests. Anyway, I've always had that feeling. I mean, I'm not quite sure how to say it, but just dependable, and they'll do what they say they're going to do to a very high percentage, you know. Anyway, Coben was a little outside of that.
Coben was great too. I sat session with him and got to know him a little bit. But yeah, you know. But I wanted to say something about American, because I like Americans and I like American Zen and I'm American. But about Suzuki Roshi, since your work, the incredible, wonderful work that you've done, David Chadwick, to archive and make available all the teachings of Suzuki Roshi. I mean, just it's just amazing and wonderful what you've done. I never met Suzuki Roshi. In fact, the first time I went to California, I had heard something about Sun Zen Temple somewhere east of Big Sur. I think it was because I saw that movie. There was a movie from
Sunseed.
Sunseed, yes. And Suzuki Roshi was there, and I think Baker Roshi was in it. So I knew there was some kind of Zen. I'd read Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. This was in
Baker wasn't in it. Baker wasn't in it. He was
okay.
In Japan,
well, whatever. Anyway, he was in the book that I'd seen, also called Be Here Now by Ram Dass. And there was a picture of Suzuki Roshi and Baker Roshi. Maybe that was later. Anyway, I had some vague idea that there was a Zen temple somewhere there, and I didn't, Anyway, I was down in Big Sur, and I was, in 69 in the summer, and first time I came to California, and looking for, the road from Big Sur to this monastery, which I didn't find it, because you can't get there from Big Sur by car. But so I never met Suzuki Roshi. When I first came to San Francisco Zen Center, as I said, at 78, after already being, kind of grounded in Sazen and Soto Zen and Dogen and all, one of the things that impressed me, and it took a little while to see it, was that the people who, a lot of people around, the people who were, who were direct students of Suzuki Roshi, they didn't fit some Zen mold, they weren't, they were all, really themselves, and a lot of them were really strange and weird, but they were really themselves. So I'm thinking of people like Ed Brown and Paul Disco and Reb and Catherine Thass in her own way, and Blanche and Lou, and I'm going to leave some out, but especially David Chadwick. We're all like really strange particular people. They were not, Zen statues or something. They weren't they didn't fit into some mold, and that really impressed me. And that's my feeling about Suzuki Roshi, that he helped people to really be themselves, and all these strange, weird, wonderful people, and they were. So
that's well said. That's well said. He was quite non-judgmental and accepting, and his way of teaching was appreciated by a very broad spectrum of people, so that those who gathered around him, a lot of them would never have been together if it weren't for him. It was a lot of characters, a lot of really, and that Tassajara stories, which I would love to finish this year, but these podcasts, they take up all my time, but we'll see. It really brings out a lot of that because it really focuses on students.
A lot of well people. ESOT is another one, you know.
Yes. Hey, got another question. I'm sure I said when I mentioned you in comments on chapter one, and if I didn't, I should be scolded, that you you helped me with both the Thank You and Okay and Americans in Failure in Japan and with Crooked Cucumber. Like you went over the books to, I used you as my scholarly to approve or disapprove. You also, though, judged. I had a group of people who, like, graded every chapter and made comments. I mean, you did a broader thing than that. But I relied on you a lot for, you know, am I using this term right? What I'm saying about Buddhism here, is it right? Because I'm not near as educated as you are, not near as educated about Buddhism as a lot of Buddhists.
But I have to say something. You have provided us with not just Crooked Cucumber, but these huge archives of material about Suzuki Roshi, which I used that. It was very valuable for me when I did the book on Dogen and the Lotus Sutra, because Suzuki Roshi talked about the Lotus Sutra. But I have to also say, David Chadwick, anybody who's listening who has not read Thank You and Okay, A Zen Failure in Japan, that is one of the funniest books I've ever read. And it's very revealing about Japan and America and at least one period of Japanese and American Zen. And so if you haven't read that book, Thank You and Okay, who publishes it, David?
But it's Shambhala now. It was Penguin. Okay. Penguin originally. I just got the audio rights because they just... I just did a second book of vignettes to follow Zen Right is Right Here, and it's going to be published next year, hardback, with Zen is Right Here. I recommended they call it Zen is Right Now, and I tailored it to that. They're going to publish them together as a hardback set and separately.
Thank you and okay?
No. I'm working up to that.
Right.
No, that's just those are little book of vignettes, right? It's more collecting, and you know, I did a little bit of editing, but there's not much me in there. But as part of the deal I made with them, and I have a very friendly relationship with Shambhala, is to get the audio rights for Thank You and Okay. And I have them for Crooked Cucumber. Thank you, Broadway Books. Got them a long time ago, before audiobooks were a big thing. And now, when I first started talking to Shambhala about getting the audio rights to Thank You and Okay, they had nothing going with audio rights. And I even got hold of them to suggest I do it for them, but they weren't doing it. And then I got into podcasts and I realized, oh my God, I want to do this. So they gave me the audio rights. They said they just signed a deal with Audible to do all their books as audio books. And they said, but I can do podcasts. And I said, well, really, that book's not important to you, and it's important to me, and I don't want to share audio rights. And they said, okay. It was very nice. Thanks for the plug. Your check will be in the mail tomorrow. Okay, so what was I going to ask? Oh, all right. But there's, you know, as I read Crooked Cucumber now, and I've never really read the book since I wrote it. However, I've had to go over parts of it. I've had to skim through parts of it for different things. You know, it just came out in Japanese in November. And I was involved with that for a couple of years. And I come across things. I use a different... I don't read from the book because there's so many little changes I've made. And I have it on Cuke.com, chapter by chapter, you know, with notes and stuff. Uh, And I just found just 2 days ago, I found another mistake, an error.
Yeah,
Daihonzan spelled Daihozan. Just a mistake that nobody know. And I can't tell you how many people went over there. And I get, well, I find mistakes.
Well, just to say that, just about that, in several of my books, at least, there are small errors and typos and stuff. Because of the publisher, and I have a record of those, and I just send them to the publisher, but they don't reprint those. So there's, in Cultivating the Empty Field and in a couple of others, there are, you know, anyway, that's part of the...
Well, they're not gonna make corrections unless they do another printing. But I collect them all, and I have an errata section on Kuk.com. I haven't entered the last ones. And going over for the Japanese translation, there were a number of changes. But
you have erotic excerpts.
I have on Kuk.com in the Cricket okay. Cucumber section.
I was
an erotic
making a bad
page.
Pun.
It's quite extensive.
I thought you were saying that you had erotic sections.
Oh, what'd you say? Oh, an erotic section. I'm sorry. I stepped on your joke. Shame on me. All right. But there is one thing in chapter 4 I just read that I got to, and I went, really? And, you know, I looked into it and went, where does that come from? And that is translating Sesshin as mind gathering. Which is, and it says literally a mind gathering. It's more literal. It would be touching my, you know, contacting the mind or touching the mind, right?
Yeah, I think I have talked about it as assembling mind, gathering the mind, or gathering. You know, there's all these. But I would say. I forget how I translate Sesshin, but it's, you know, these Chinese characters that are part of these words, like the Setsu and Sesshin, you know, have numbers of meanings. So there's always overtones. So, you know, that's the problem with translating, is that a lot of times you have, in English is much more precise than Chinese or Sino-Japanese. And so you have to pick one of a number of meanings. And sometimes you add a footnote, but I call Sesshin gathering the mind. Gathering the mind heart.
Oh, so you agree with it? That's great. See, that's why you didn't change it when you went over it, and I didn't change it either. I read it that way, and I made a note to look into it. And you know, I looked into it superficially. And I was waiting to ask you, because I imagine word came from Suzuki, you know, because I remember it being called mind gathering back when nobody at Zen Center knew any Japanese or classical Japanese. It had to come from him. And Richard Baker used to say it, and he wouldn't have just made it up out of nowhere. He can be very poetic in his explanation of things, but it might have come out of a conversation.
Well, I wouldn't say mind. I would say gathering. I'm looking in my books and questions to see how I translated it, because I did specifically in the chapter on Bob Dylan, I talked about Sesshin and I translate that word, Sesshin, and I'm looking to see how I did it then. Hold on just a second. I'm a page before it. I wouldn't say... I said Sesshin means to gather or meet the mind or to settle into Zen mind, which is a looser, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Thank you. All right, here's another thing I wanted to bring up. One thing that really irritates me about, you know, of course, mainstream media is sort of, you know, you can't live without it, but it's just simple, oversimplifies everything, and it's sort of wrong about everything in a way. But that one of the worst things it does is just deal with religion in general. It can only deal with, like, fundamentalist, literal religion. It can't get any more subtle than that. And that's been especially emphasized recently, where they like to oppose things. So it's always faith or science, right?
Yeah, that's just wrong. That's just totally wrong.
Crazy. And when I'm, it's just totally wrong. You know, one thing I have said to people, I've gotten through to some, you know, scientists that thought of all religion as, you know, just a bunch of superstitious nonsense. And they certainly all, you can't say they all do, because there's plenty of scientists that have very sophisticated understanding of things, including Einstein. But one thing I would say is there's no possible contradiction between religion and science. If the word religion is my translation of it, which is, you know, I don't have any one translation, but waking up to reality, you know, and if we're not talking about literalism, which is to me just, you know, nonsense, believing in particular stories as being absolute truth and worshiping, well, action figures and stuff. But one thing I say is that Buddhism, two of the central teachings of Buddhism are evolution and relativity, which are like cornerstones of science these days.
Well, I think there's a mistranslation involved, David. So, and this is an issue that in terms of trying to translate Japanese or Chinese into English, the word faith, which you used, means in some parts of Judeo-Christian tradition, means belief in some deity or dogma or something. And faith is very, very important in Zen and in Buddhism. And, you know, even within Buddhist studies, they, you know, make a distinction between, you know, practice like Zazen Buddhism as opposed to faith Buddhism, devotional Buddhism. But, you know, Soto Zen is very devotional. But the word faith, when I there are words that could be translated into English as faith, but it doesn't mean belief in something. There's no object. It's just, I sometimes translate it as trust or confidence.
That's what Suzuki Roshi used. Confidence.
Yeah.
He specifically said he thought so, confidence was a better word to use.
The article I'm working on now is about within Dogen, and there's a particular essay involved, but that, you know, sometimes they make a distinction between devotion or faith on the one hand and, you know, kind of nature imagery and natural imagery, and which is part of Zen from, you know, going back to Taoism, but they're not separate at all. And so to see practice and devotion as separate is just a mistake, and it's not what Dogen is about. I wrote a...
Right. However, you've spent time in Japan, and I found many Buddhists in Asia have a sort of childlike faith in specific that, you know, in I've seen on TV Sunday school stuff in Japan where Buddha is like a god that you worship and believe in. And was go completely against Buddhist teacher, and it'll have, like, I remember little soul drops. There's a big soul, and then a little drop comes from the big soul, and that's the person is born, and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, but and that's the common, you know, Japanese popular Buddhism is all about, includes that sense of religiosity, which isn't separate from practice. It's just not, you know, we think of that as separate, like doing zazen is one thing and saying Nami to Buddha or something is another, but really the sense of, you know, we chant the names of the Buddha ancestors in our, you know, in the Zen Center tradition, for example, and Zen.
Oh yeah, I do all sorts of stuff like I say thank you all the time, and then a friend of mine said, well, who are you saying thank you to? and I said, there's really, I there's no object. I don't know what the object is. And I talk about that in Thank You and
Yes.
Okay, the Okage Samade, that phrase they use, you know, thanks be to, you know, to whatever.
Another word to put in there, yeah. Also thinking of gratitude and gratefulness, and
gratitude, right? And gratitude practice, and I don't see a contradiction between Shinran's type of Jodo Shinshu practice.
Yes, thank you, I'm already saved.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely. And Zen, which is supposed to be self-power, and it's the other power. And, well, that doesn't need to be that distinction.
I wrote an article about Dogen Zazen as other power practice. It's on the Ancient Dragon website. Anyway.
Cool. Check it out. You mentioned Sunseed. I've been in touch with Amartat Cohen, Frederick Cohen, who made it in recent years. He's, you know, I just Googled it. I can't find it. I thought he brought it out again. He's trying to bring it out again. But I went on IMDb while we were talking, and I don't see it. And I thought he'd tell me, because he asked me a lot of questions. I gave him a lot of information. All the names, well, I actually have all the names of all the people on shunyusuzuki.com in the film section. I have all of it, and I have like 100 snapshots from it, and everybody's name is in it and all that. Don't tell him, because they made me take it off of YouTube video. That's how I got in touch with him, because it got taken off because of copyright infringement.
Oh, well.
He lives over in Kuala Lumpur, and we go to Kuala Lumpur. I haven't seen him since back in 1970 when they were at Tassajara. In fact, I don't remember. I remember Ralph Silver, who actually was the director of the film, and much better. And Ralph used to come to Zen Center. So, anyway, Taigen, look at how long we've gone on.
I want to say something else. Which is that, we haven't spoken much about my time at San Francisco Zen Center, which was long and rich, and you know, as I practiced in all those places. But I want to say something about Tassajara Bakery, because, in some ways, all the businesses that Bakereshi tried to start, in the long run, well, Greens is still there, I mean, before the pandemic anyway, and is you know, important. But actually before I went to Tassajara, when I first came, a year after or so after I moved to San Francisco, I gave up being a film editor and working in TV news, which is what I was doing, and went to work for Tassajara Bakery.
Right.
And that was one of the best practice places I've ever been at. So I just wanted to say that since we're talking about, you know, Zen Center, I know you worked at Greens and I worked at Greens for a while too, and that was wonderful too. But when I started at Tassajara Bakery, and I worked there before and after I went to Tassajara Monastery, it was just this wonderful practice place because there were, you know, at least for a while, everybody who was practicing there was also sitting Zazen every day. And I was working together with, you know, more experienced, you know, like Zen priests, and I wasn't ordained yet then. And it was just, and we were just all working together for Zen Center. And that was, so even, you know, I mean, I think Hiroshi gets criticized some for a lot of things, but that experiment in self-sufficiency, it was not sustainable, but Tassajara Bakery, the greengrocer, the Greens, and that was a wonderful, wonderful practice place. I remember I worked in the back, I worked in the front and the back. I worked with Ulysses and Ken Sawyer and Jay Simino later with Catherine Dennis and Therese. Anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful practice place. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. It was wonderful when we had these businesses, and there were Zen students working in all of them, and I actually was against Zen centers downsizing, and you know, the businesses what Richard Baker set up at Zen Center has continued to support Zen Center. 85%, I just learned, because I'm in touch with Miles, who's the in charge, Mal Coward, and who's the in charge of development at Zen Center. He told me that how hard it is for Zen Center to get by without the income from Tassajara and Greens. He said Zen Center businesses, which I'd say include
Because of Baker Roshi, period.
He said they provide 85% of Zen Center support.
Yeah.
I had no idea. So Zen Center's really in a tough place now. You know, when Steve Stuckey and Paul Haller were the co-abbots of Zen Center, they gave a presentation. I was at a no race at Tassajara where supporters and friends of Zen Center, it's Memorial Day weekend or near there, go to Tassajara and it's like the open, right before the guest season opens. It's like 3 days. And part of it was they gave a presentation to the group of, you know, Zen Center's master plan and what for the future. I personally, I didn't like seeing Paul Haller and Steve Stuckey there, you know, giving the pitch for funds for Zen Center. I thought other people ought to do that as abbots. I didn't think they should. But anyway, that didn't matter. That's not my point. That was like maybe 12 years ago or something. It was a long time ago. It was
after I moved to Chicago.
Yeah. Though. Oh, it was. That you moved to Chicago 13 years ago. I asked a question at that meeting. And I asked if there, in the master plan, because they were talking about 100-year plans, I said, do you have you included what to do. Have you included global warming and, you know, the possibility of things happening that just cause fundamental changes in society and that sort of thing? And they said, no. And it's so obvious that things are not going to continue on a line that they've been going on. But anyway,
I was a part of an effort that Peter Coyote and Alan Sinofsky and I forget who else, maybe Rebecca Solnit, were trying to get the board, this was much more recently, the board of San Francisco Zen Center to divest from fossil fuels. And I don't know that that's happened completely. It's difficult to do that because of the way that corporate things are kind of bundled together.
Yeah, divested. How are they invested in fossil fuel? Oh, because they have money in Fidelity.
Yeah, in some of those funds. I'm not sure the exact details, but yeah. And
I've never put money in. Well, I've always put money into my work. our music, one or the other, right? So I never invest. But when I did have some money, I bought U.S. Treasury bonds, I-bonds, which move with inflation. I was against putting money in the stock market as being like gambling.
There is socially responsible investing these days, and you know, but it's complicated. But anyway,
my feeling. But that's really good to hear. You all tried to get Zen Center to do that.
And I think they've done some things. And I know Linda Ruth Cuss has been very active in terms of, working for alternative power and about climate. And you know, there was Linda Ruth. There's a whole tradition at Zen Center.
Oh, Linda Ruth.
And this partly also has to do with Baker Roshi, but not just him. But there's a tradition at Zen Center of Catherine, Blanche particularly also, but of you know social action or social concern. And
oh yeah, Baker is totally into all that.
I remember going down to. I guess at the depot at Green Gulch in downtown in San Francisco in the early 80s during the nuclear freeze movement and doing a weekly vigil against, nuclear power and nuclear weapons. So anyway,
Right. A lot of us were involved in the nuclear freeze movement and so was Baker. He got very
many people. Yeah,
and you and John Bales. John Bales became head of the San Francisco. What was the name of it? The San Francisco chapter of Citizens for Nuclear Freeze or whatever. Green's Restaurant. I arranged it. You know, it was an event I did, but. But Baker enthusiastically let Greens be used for the first public presentation of the last epidemic. Ian Tierman. He and his son. And Rusty Schweigart, who was my father-in-law-to-be, spoke. And there was an impressive number of people there. That place was packed, and a lot of them people that the nuclear freeze really wanted to get to. And I was offered the head, to be the head of the Californians for Nuclear Freeze for Northern California. Albie Wells, a prominent Republican who was CEO of U.S. Leasing, a multi-billion dollar corporation, turned his offices over to it, and he came to Green Gulch. And offered me that position, and I said, "Albie, you don't know me."
Yes, well, that was very good of you, dude.
I said, "I'd be coming in drunk and stoned, and You know, I'd be wanting to run off with the secretaries. I said, I'm good for ad hoc events or for arranging meetings with people. Yeah, you don't want me there. And he went, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you telling me that.
In relation to that, that's part of my history of civil disobedience. I was arrested a couple times at Livermore Labs and at Vandenberg Air Force Base a few times. So,
yeah, well, you've gone to the White House. You've gone to the White House.
I was in the White House.
This
was a Buddhist meeting. This was something that was organized. There was a guy from the Buddhist side, a guy from Soka Gakkai, who's active in Nichiren Nam-myoho Renge-kyo group. They're very active socially and very active in terms of peace work. And anyway, but yeah, there was a large gathering of Buddhist teachers and clergy from. My memory for years is
what
bad.
Year? What year?
Barack Obama.
Who was president?
Remember him? So it was like, I don't know, 2005 something like that. Yeah. I don't know exactly. But anyway, it was pretty cool. And I've been involved in, you know, that kind of stuff. Civil disobedience, that goes back for me to the Vietnam War, because I was protesting that a lot in high school. And then I went to Columbia College just in time to get to be part of the occupation in 68 for a week and was arrested there. And anyway, that's sort of in the background of my Zen practice. Uh-huh. But I relate it to the whole Bodhisattva idea that, you know, it's universal awakening. And we have to, you know, like right now, be aware and try to help with all the people in distress. And
yeah, your social justice work has been more involved. It's been more peace work.
Then the Iraq War, and you know, anyway, I've been involved with peace work going back to Vietnam in high school.
Yeah. Anyway, you've been very consistent with that, and I appreciate it. Anything else you want to? I want to bring up one thing about when you worked in the bakery. One morning, you would go like very early morning over there and stand over on Haight Street.
That's right.
And wait for the bus.
Like you can.
One street up. Right by the projects, a very dangerous place. And one day, a couple of guys pulled you into the projects, put a gun to your head, and one guy was saying, and you told me about this like right after it happened, one guy was saying, shoot him, come on, shoot him. And the other guy didn't do it. And they just were...
Well, I gave them the wallet.
They wanted to get some money.
Sure, yeah.
You remember that?
I first worked in the bakery. Later, I worked in the front, but for a long while, I worked in the back of the bakery, and we would go in like 3:30 in the morning to get the Danish and the croissants and the bread ready. That was a weird thing, because then we'd come back at noon and try and sit zazen in the Zendo downstairs from City Center when we were totally exhausted. taking the bus there one morning, a couple of guys held me up at gunpoint. The guy with the gun was more afraid than I was. He was shaking. And I just said, hey, man, be cool, and here's my wallet, and, you know, it's okay. I just responded, you know, because... I think zazen. I don't know.
Well, you did a good job. You passed that test.
Yeah, one guy was saying to shoot. Yeah, I had forgotten that. But, you know, right afterwards, I called the police.
Well, I remember more the guy with a gun, because he was facing me with a gun in my face, but he was, you know, and I was addressing him. I was like, be cool, it's okay, and you know, I was trying to calm him down and breathe, and you know, anyway. And then afterwards, the police came, and we walked around in the projects. And I found my wallet. The money was gone, but I got my wallet with, you know, cards and all that. So, you know, all the adventures back in Vincent, that was an interesting place back then.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew a few people who got killed, died there.
I was living on Haight and Octavia at the time when Chris Persick was killed. He died right outside my window of my apartment. I was sitting zazen at the time, and I ran out. You know, it was one of the first people out there. And that's a whole other long story, but yeah.
His mother listens to these podcasts, and she and I correspond, Wendy.
Well, Chris was... He was a really good kid. I didn't know him super well. He worked at the bakery. That was just before I started working at the bakery. But, you know, I would, you know, have dinner with him at City Center. And he was just smart, kind of quiet in a way. Anyway, he was a good guy. That whole thing that happened was just terrible. Anyway, it had a big impact on me.
Yeah, no kidding.
Big impact on me in lots of ways.
Yeah, it's terrible. Well, on that cheery note.
No, we have to end on an up note. Something wonderful.
Well, I can just take that and stick it earlier.
Well, you know, I just I'm really grateful to Suzuki Roshi and all the people who, you know, have continued his work, and David Chadwick, especially to you for all the work you've done on the archive. And you know, I'm out here in Chicago, and you know, I feel separate from or apart from in a lot of ways, but also connected. So a lot of my students here in Chicago were in a non-residential center, as I said at the beginning, but a lot of my students have gone to do like January intensive at Green Gulch with Reb, or gone to Tassajara, or stayed longer at Green Gulch. And so for me, I have a number of priests, last year I did Dharma transmission for my two senior priests, which was, you know, wonderful to do. Vicki Austin helped a lot with that.
Wait a minute. You did Dharma transmission with?
For two of my senior priests. Their names are Nyozon Eric Shutt and Asian Nancy Easton. They've both spent time. Nyozon Eric did two practice periods at Tassajara with Steve Stuckey a while ago, and then more recently with Norman. Nancy Asian has done a few January intensives with Reb at Green Gulch. So, you know, part of my training priests is that they get a chance to go and spend time and get a taste of residential practice somewhere at Zen Center. So I have that connection. Yeah. And right now, during the pandemic, one of the positive side effects, Reb Anderson, who gave me Dharma transmission at Tassajara in 2000. I before I moved to Chicago, I used to go to his Friday senior seminars, and now with his senior students, and now they're on Zoom, so I get to see him and my Dharma siblings every week, and so that's, you know, a positive side effect of this, and we're studying some interesting stuff. So anyway, so my connection with, you know, in some ways, Zen Center was Zen Center was challenging for me, but I'm so grateful for, you know, what Suzuki Roshi started and all the people who continued it. And so thank you for all the work you're doing, David.
Yeah, I'd like to say one thing about that is that the QCARC Archives has really more on it on other people than it does on Suzuki. I mean, it's got an enormous amount on just people who passed through had some connection that I consider relevant. I mean, there's a lot on you. There's, you know, many, you know, there's probably 100 pages on his wife.
Oh, she was wonderful. Oh, Oksan, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, she was so, she did this wonderful thing. She stayed at Zen Center.
Yeah, yeah. So I see it as, I always emphasize preserving the legacy of Shunyu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his. And those people don't have to have met him.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's like I said, when I saw that all the strange, weird, wonderful people who had directly studied with him, I got a sense of him from all of you, you know.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what you've done. I think it's been great, and what you will continue doing. And, you know, somebody gave me a great quote recently. I know, it was a quote from Basho saying, don't try to follow the tracks of your teacher. Or, you know, your teachers in this. Search for what they searched for.
That's a good one.
It was something, I mean, you know, I don't have it quite exactly right, but it was something like, I thought that, oh, that's really good.
You know, I'll tell you something else. When I did this 3-week Dharma transmission with Reb in 2000, the year 2000, in spring at Tassajara, and as I left afterwards, as I was getting onto the stage, he just said to me, don't run away from yourself.
Uh-huh.
Something like that. Don't try and escape. Uh-huh. That was it. So, yeah, just to be yourself in the deepest, deepest sense is our practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned a few of the people who had studied with Suzuki Roshi, who inspired me when I first got to Zen Center, Mel and Ananda, or a couple of more. And Jerome, I didn't mention Jerome. Jerome was the weirdest and the most wonderful of all in some ways.
Oh, yeah, Jerome was great. Jerome was inspiring.
Yeah.
And people, most people didn't realize it, is what I feel.
Yeah, he was brilliant. He was brilliant.
Yeah. He was... Yeah, I mean, he was really something. And his Shuso ceremony was the most, it just totally blew my mind and other people's minds. He just swatted everybody away. Like it was, you know, Jerome was a misfit who wasn't really comfortable in normal society. And man, but he liked Zen Center. He always liked being at Zen Center. But, you know, he wasn't appreciated in Zen Center, and he was sort of, in many ways, he wasn't. He was, and he wasn't. But
I always appreciated him.
When he was Shuso, man, when he sat on that altar in his Shuso ceremony, he was the most at home there.
Yeah.
And was just wonderful.
Yeah. Not to this week, but the week after this, on Thursday the 28th, would you please attend the discussion about Suzuki Roshi on Zoom at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate? I do not lead that. It's not a formal class. The person leading that night will be, her name is Paula Lazars. Shudo is her. She's a priest. She's also a martial arts teacher. She teaches Qigong. She has her own martial arts studio. It's through her and her, she's from the Shaolin martial arts tradition, and through her and with the help of my friend Stephen Hine, we discovered that the Shaolin martial arts tradition, you know, if you watch Kung Fu and all that, they say it went back to Bodhidharma, but it actually started with a student of a teacher who was a disciple of the commentator for the Book of Serenity. The Book of Serenity, it was started by Hongzhe, who I translated. He did the pick the cases and the verses, but there's a commentator named Wansong, who I found out a lot about. He's a very interesting guy. He is the commentator for the Book of Serenity that Cleary translated, and he had...
Give me a year. Give me a year. When did he exist?
He was same century as Dogen, but later, late 1200s. In early 1300s. Bodhidharma was at Shaolin in like whatever it was, 600 or something, 650. But Wansong's had three very interesting disciples. One of them became, Wansong is the commentator of the Book of Serenity. One of them became the abbot at Shaolin. And he's the one who brought together, I guess there was lots of civil war and bandits on the roads. And he brought to Shaolin all the martial arts, a lot of martial arts people from all of China. So he wasn't a martial arts teacher himself, but he gathered them, and that's when the Shaolin martial arts tradition started. And he was Cao Dong, or we could say Soto, lineage, and his lineage continues at Shaolin. So Shaolin is a Soto temple. It's a Cao Dong, a Chinese Soto temple, still.
Far out.
Yeah, and nobody, I don't think anybody in the West knew that until we start.
I wonder if Andy Ferguson or Bill Porter are aware of that.
I'm not sure if they are, but I wrote up a whole thing about Wansong. I can try and send you. But anyway, so I...
Yeah, do, because I want to send it to them.
Okay, but anyway, I discovered this because of Paula's interest.
At this point, Daigen and I veered off into talking about some other stuff that doesn't really fit here. And then I said, yeah, all right, well, it's been good. Give my love to Naomi and, all the neat people I met when I was there before, give them my love and great talking with you. And at that point, we ventured off into other stuff too, so that he never really got a chance to say goodbye to you all. But I know that I expressed Tigan's feelings when I say he's really enjoyed being here. And please drop by the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and practice Zazen with them, or come to a lecture when you're in Chicago. So, this has been another Geuk Audio Chat. I'm DC Buba of Geuk Audio and Geuk Archives, wishing you a grand awakening.